This is a CBC podcast. On December 31st, 1997, at a New Year's Eve party, Cheryl Shepherd was proposed to on live TV. 2 days later, she disappeared and was never seen again. Host David Richin heads to Hamilton, Ontario to investigate the case. Someone Knows Something, Season 2. Subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. Provinces, cities, and towns across this country are struggling against a crushing wave of opioid addiction. In British Columbia alone, there were 332 deadly fentanyl-related overdoses between January and September. That's according to the provincial coroner's office. If you roll in other opioids, the number doubles. Canadians are the second highest consumers of opioids worldwide after the U.S. So today on Quirks and Quarks, we're going to take a scientific look at Canada's opioid crisis. What happens to your brain and body when you take a drug that's 50 times more potent than heroin? What havoc does a fentanyl addiction wreak on your body? And what happens when you overdose? We'll hear the stories of two people who've used fentanyl. One is in the process of recovery, and the other is a former addict. Plus, we'll discover a valley on the planet Mercury that dwarfs the Grand Canyon. Learn how scientists are able to replace bad memories with good ones. Separate AI fact from fiction on the hit show Westworld, and journey deep below the Earth's surface to a supply of water that's crucial for our survival. All this on Quirks and Quarks.
I didn't have enough from my doctor to keep my habit going, so I had to turn to the streets to buy fentanyl patches. I had to talk to a friend of mine who was also addicted to fentanyl, and he said, well, why don't you try eating it? You'll feel a lot better. And that's how it started. I took a sliver and I put it in my mouth. I chewed on it for half an hour, and I felt like $1 million.
That's Chris Fagan, a former addict, talking about literally chewing a patch containing the drug fentanyl because he couldn't feed his addiction any other way. Well, things have changed for Chris. Today, he helps other people get over their addictions, and a lot of people need that help. This week, medical health experts called on the government to declare a public emergency over the opioid crisis. So on the show today, we're going to examine what happens to the body and brain of a fentanyl addict. What happens when someone's high, when they're in withdrawal, or when they overdose? Here to help me with that is Dr. David Yearlink. He's head of clinical pharmacology and toxicology at the University of Toronto. Dr. Yearlink, thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Bob.
This week we spoke to two people, one who uses fentanyl and is trying to stop. The other is a former addict, and they told us in graphic detail about their experiences. And in a moment, you're going to help us with the scientific breakdown of what they're going through. But first, where did fentanyl actually come from?
So fentanyl was synthesized in the 1960s in response to a search for stronger painkillers. So it belongs to a class of drugs called opioids. Drugs like morphine and codeine and even heroin are in that class. But fentanyl is, its chemical structure is different. It doesn't look on the surface like those other drugs, but it's much more potent. And so very small quantities of fentanyl can do what larger quantities of morphine do.
Well, how do these drugs actually work in the brain?
Drugs like fentanyl and morphine work by stimulating what we call opioid receptors. These are, you can think of these as almost like locks that a key will fit into. And so you view the chemical as the key and the receptor as the lock. The chemical comes along and it binds to and it stimulates the receptor. And this is how they alleviate pain, and they also effect some of their pleasurable effects as well that way.
So you feel good in addition to losing the pain.
That's correct. I mean, some people do. I mean, to be fair, if you give a certain number of people, when they are given morphine or fentanyl, they feel awful. They feel, they get nauseated, they feel itchy, they just can't take it again. but for some people, they feel really terrific. And that's part of how these drugs are helpful, but also part of how we find ourselves getting into trouble with them.
Well, why is the fentanyl so much more potent than something like morphine?
It has to do with how it binds to the receptor. So it's partly a function of being more fat-soluble. So these drugs have to get into the brain, you know, get from the blood into the brain in the first place, and that's a process that involves traversing something called the blood-brain barrier, a structure that's in place that normally tries to keep things from entering the brain. But fentanyl is a very lipophilic compound. It passes the blood-brain barrier freely, and it fits into the receptor really nicely and stimulates it in very small quantities.
It's a better-fitting key.
That's exactly right.
Okay, I want to bring in the voice of another guest. He wishes to remain anonymous, so we'll call him Mike. And here's some of the reasons that he takes the drug.
It's like, imagine, it's like being on a tropical island, a nice warm breeze comes over you, and it gives you a nice warm feeling, a nice sense of ease, and nice sense of well-being, and puts you at ease.
That sounds pretty good.
It does, and it probably relates to the fact that these drugs don't just influence one transmitter system. They have cascading effects on others. So one of the things that when you give somebody fentanyl or oxycodone, which is the ingredient in OxyContin, there's also a release of dopamine, which is a chemical that has a lot to do with how we perceive pleasure.
It's a feel-good hormone.
It is, and so these drugs will cause a larger surge in dopamine release and a longer surge in dopamine than you might get from, say, eating something you like or from doing exercise.
Okay, let's hear from Mike again, and here he's describing the opposite, the symptoms of withdrawal.
I can remember one time sitting on a toilet with a bucket in front of me. It's like fluids coming out of every orifice of your body, like flowing up, diarrhea. You even have this odor that you can smell. Like you feel like you can smell yourself. It's terrible. You're very edgy. You're exhausted, like completely exhausted, and yet you can't sleep. I mean, it's hell.
So why does a person feel so sick when they're withdrawing from fentanyl?
So what happens here is that the body becomes accustomed to the presence of the drug. And when the drug is suddenly taken away or when the dose is lowered, the withdrawal symptoms will ensue. And so it's effectively the body's way of saying, where the heck is the drug? It relates in part to the fact that when you are chronically exposed to a drug like fentanyl, the opioid receptor, we say, is downregulated. What happens is your body kind of becomes more numb to the effects of the drug. It sort of takes the receptors and the numbers of them decrease in quantity. And so when the drug is suddenly taken away, this is sort of the body's way of revolting and insisting that the drug be brought back.
Now, what about that odor that Mike described? What would cause that?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. We do know that many of these chemicals influence olfaction or the ability to smell things, and so I wouldn't be surprised if it's related to that, but I honestly don't know.
Hmm. Now, people who are trying to get clean will use a drug called Suboxone.
Suboxone is the brand name, and there are generics out there too, but there are two main drugs. Buprenorphine is the main ingredient in Suboxone, and methadone is the other drug.
Okay, so here's Mike's experience with taking it.
I'm on Suboxone right now, but I there are days when I won't take it because I know that within the next couple of days that I'm going to use. And then when I use and I get over it, then I go back on the Suboxone.
Well, how can a person still get high when they're using medication that's supposed to prevent them from getting high?
What he was alluding to with Suboxone, the fact that it's kind of different from the other opioids. It's not what we call a full agonist. Something like morphine or fentanyl is a full agonist, meaning that when you give those to a patient, they achieve maximal stimulation of the opioid receptor. Buprenorphine, the main ingredient in Suboxone, doesn't quite stimulate it the same way. In fact, it kind of partially blocks it a little bit too. And so when he's alluding to holding off on the Suboxone, it's because if he anticipates using fentanyl again, if he still had Suboxone in his system, it would partially blunt the response that he otherwise might have had to the fentanyl.
Okay, this next clip is kind of tough to listen to.
I've had a friend of mine die in an alleyway here in Toronto, and I put him in a chair and took him to St. Mike's because thankfully it was only a block away. And they brought him back. And he overdosed about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago.
Well, that's a tragic story, and Dr. Yerlich, I'm sure that's one you're all too familiar with. But what happens to a person when they overdose?
The primary concern with an overdose is that when the quantity of opioid is too high, the person's consciousness declines, but also their breathing stops. So opioids affect many parts of the brain, but in the brainstem, the lower part of the brain rests our breathing center, our respiratory center. And what opioids do is they effectively turn that off at high doses. And so if someone's got an opioid overdose, what you'll see is that not only are they unconscious, but they are breathing less and less frequently, and eventually they're not breathing at all. And the obvious consequences of that is that tissues like the brain don't get oxygen and then they therefore die.
Now, he said that they brought him back. How would emergency doctors have done that?
That would be done with the use of a drug called naloxone, which is kind of the antidote to these opioids. It effectively kicks those other drugs off of the receptor and takes the place. It doesn't actually do anything to the receptor except occupy it. So somebody who's got an opiate overdose, you know, within a minute or two of getting naloxone is wide awake and they are breathing normally, but they are also in withdrawal. And so more than once I've seen patients who, you know, have been on the verge of death, and we'll give them naloxone and they're now alive again. But they're in withdrawal, and they often, I mean, it's very unpleasant. I mean, it's acutely triggered withdrawal by an intervention that's meant to try and save their life.
Boy. Well, we know from speaking to Mike that he's trying to break his addiction, but our next guest is a little further down that road. Chris Fagan is a former addict, and his fentanyl addiction started in a very different way. He was hospitalized after a car accident left him with a brain injury and terrible headaches. Here he is.
My doctor had gone to a conference, and he came back. He had never heard of the patch, and he just thought at the time it would be a lot easier for me to put a patch on for 3 days than taking pills. And that was my first time on fentanyl. Started at 12.5 micrograms every 3 days, 12.5, then it went to 25 micrograms, to 50, to 75, to 100.
Now, why would he need to keep upping it like that? Why was he not feeling the effect of fentanyl as much?
So he's describing a phenomenon called tolerance. And what you'll often see is patients, they start on a drug like fentanyl for pain. The pain relief is initially there, but then it kind of goes away. And when the pain is back, physicians were taught that you could simply increase the dose of opioids to try and compensate for that. That doesn't work quite as well as we were told it would.
Well, I mean, broadly speaking then, knowing what we know about fentanyl, should doctors even be prescribing it?
You'll get different answers to that depending on who you talk to. It's a remarkably useful and versatile drug in the hospital. We give it intravenously in the hospital for pain relief and a few other indications. In the treatment of pain as an outpatient, I mean, it's valuable for patients with cancer and patients at end of life. It is such a potent opioid that my view is that for patients with chronic pain, by the time somebody gets to a fentanyl patch, it's not that it should never be used, but I think more often than not, that's a testament to the failure of opioids to relieve that person's pain. And transitioning them to fentanyl is often asking for trouble.
Here's another clip from Chris talking about eating it.
Someone, I had talked to a friend of mine who was also addicted to fentanyl, and he said, well, why don't you try eating it? You'll feel a lot better. And that's how it started. I took the sliver and I put it in my mouth. I chewed on it for half an hour and I felt like $1 million. And that's how it escalated from that. It started with little slivers to, taking 200 micrograms a day at the end, eating it orally.
So what's going on in the brain as the person increases the amount of fentanyl that they're taking?
Well, they just release more of it and it's inherently more pleasurable. So by subverting the usual delivery mechanism here, the absorption through the skin, what he's done is he's chewed the patch and released a lot of fentanyl very quickly and probably felt immensely pleasurable as a result. But again, that wears off, and then the question is what happens next, and what happens next is all too often just doing the same thing again.
Well, here's Chris talking about the time he overdosed.
Well, when I didn't really know I was overdosing until it was brought to my attention that I'd be passing out. So, having dinner, talking to someone, having guests over the house, driving my vehicle and ending up in the ditch. I never knew how that all happened. I just wake up in the ditch. That's what I kind of knew I was ODing, like I was passing out. And I didn't know why I was passing out.
So Chris says he was overdosing, but he was able to wake up, and others don't wake up. So what causes some to die and others don't?
A variety of factors. I mean, it's partly just the dose makes the poison, and so these drugs will make you sleepy, and sometimes if you've got enough on board to make you sleepy but not enough to stop you from breathing, you can be roused.
Well, Chris has actually quit using opioids, but it still seems to be a lifelong struggle for him to stay off them. Let's hear it.
I talk about fentanyl every day being in the business I'm in, and it doesn't bother me. But if I go back to where I was, where my hometown, I get triggered. I'll say to myself, when I'm driving down the street, well, I won't look at the house I'm going to pass. And I always do. So there's always it's kind of like a temptation, a little devil in my head.
So it turns out Chris Fagan's a good news story. He's opened several rehab clinics in Canada, but he still has to fight the temptation of addictive drugs. Why is it so hard, even after you've quit for a while?
So addiction by its nature is a chronic relapsing condition. And it, just as he described it, there are often triggers that can make people think of or sometimes make them relapse. And I think that's a testament to the fact that we know that these drugs can, with long-term use, cause actual structural changes in the brain. If I took a patient, and in fact this has been shown before, giving modest doses of morphine, 15 milligrams twice a day for a month, you can clearly demonstrate changes in various locations of the brain, reduced amounts of gray matter here, larger amounts there. So we know that these structural changes can happen in response to opioid therapy. And I think the longer you take them and the higher the doses you take, the more dramatic they are. It's likely that there are some permanent long-term changes, and that's, I think, what he's describing.
That's astounding. It's actually rewiring the brain.
Exactly.
Are researchers working on pharmacological alternatives for pain relief that aren't as addictive as fentanyl?
I sure hope so. I mean, that's one of the really important aspects of this. But, patients, pain is a really important problem, and doctors, we see it every day, and very often medications are part of what we use to treat it. We don't have a lot of drug options at our disposal, and we've come to use opioids quite liberally for all kinds of pain over the last 20 years, in part because we were led to believe they were safer and more effective than it turns out they are.
So what do you think is the way or ways out of this opioid crisis?
I think the most urgent issue is helping people who have addiction not die, by that I mean various harm reduction strategies. So giving them drugs as buprenorphine or methadone to replace the drugs that they're presently using, which are increasingly contaminated with fentanyl from China in very, very large amounts. Giving them safe places to use them, where if they overdose, they can be resuscitated, like Insight in Vancouver. Expanding the access to the reversal antidote, naloxone. I mean, that's a life-saving drug and really should be everywhere. Those are some of the key elements of helping people with addiction. But on the other side of this is that doctors have to prescribe opioids differently for patients with pain. And I think it's fair to say that we deploy them still fairly freely, and we often use them at doses that aren't supported by good medical studies, but we do it because we've been taught that it's the right thing to do. I think the sooner we realize that these are drugs that have an important role to play, but that they carry really serious risks and harms at high doses and over the long term, the better off patients will be.
Dr. Yearley, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Mike and Chris Fagan for sharing their stories, and to Dr. David Yearley, too. He's the head of clinical pharmacology and toxicology at the University of Toronto. Coming up, Valley Deep, Mountain High. The Grand Canyon, located mostly in Arizona, is considered one of the seven natural wonders of the world, and with good reason. It's immense, nearly 450 kilometers long, just under 30 kilometers wide, and 1,800 meters deep. It's difficult to imagine, then, another canyon in which you could lose the Grand Canyon. For that, you'd have to take in the natural wonders of another world, namely the planet Mercury. A newly discovered giant valley on our solar system's innermost planet has recently been described by scientists, including Dr. Tom Waters. He's a senior scientist at the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. Like canyons here on Earth, this one also cuts deep into the geological history of its planet. Dr. Waters, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Oh, my pleasure. It's great to be here again.
Tell me about Mercury's giant valley. How big is it?
It is, as you said, it makes the Grand Canyon look pretty small. It is over 1,000 kilometers long. It is probably up to about 500 kilometers wide. And at its deepest, it is over 3 kilometers. So it is a sizable valley.
Boy.
And I like to compare it with the Great Rift Valley in East Africa, which is also a tectonically formed valley. But again, Mercury's Great Valley makes even the Great Rift Valley on the Earth looks small.
How is this valley on Mercury found?
We started off with exploring Mercury with Mariner 10, which was a mission that flew in the 70s. And Mariner 10 only flew by Mercury 3 times, and it saw roughly the same hemisphere each time it went by. So there was a whole hemisphere of Mercury that really was unimaged by spacecraft until MESSENGER arrived there in its 3 flybys before it finally went into orbit in 2011. And it was on that second flyby of Mercury that we saw this big impact basin that we had never seen before, which is now called the Rembrandt Basin. And when we saw this basin, one thing that really jumped out at me was the fact that here was one of these very large fault scarps, a scarp that basically it's a cliff-like feature. It kind of looks like a stair step in the topography if you're on the ground looking up, but it's these things are really, this one in particular is really mountainous. This fault scarp was running along and cuts right across the impact basin wall and floor, and so it turned out that that particular fault scarp is the largest fault scarp on Mercury, and the Rembrandt Basin is one of the youngest and largest impact basins on Mercury that we now know from MESSENGER. So that was sort of the start of it.
So when you talk about the Rembrandt Basin, so the basin would be circular, so like a giant crater or a depression?
That's exactly right.
And then the scarp cuts across it like a slash across it?
Yes, that's a good way of describing it. It cuts right across this rim and, again, the floor of the impact basin. So that, you would have thought, was amazing enough, and I did. But the one thing that we didn't have was that third dimension of topography. And we didn't really see that until we collected stereo imaging. And when we did that, this canyon, this great valley, popped out and literally immediately suggested a different kind of a mechanism than just the sort of general contraction of Mercury.
I'm just trying to picture this, then. You're saying that you've got these two scarps, which are basically very tall cliffs, and then
right.
A valley floor between them that's down. So,
right.
So what would you see if you were there? What would it look like?
If you were there, it would kind of look like if you were on the valley floor and looking to the north toward the largest of those two scarps, it would look like you were looking at a mountain front, the front range of a mountain chain. And if you looked again to the opposite direction, you'd see, again, another mountain chain. So it looked like you were sort of in between these two widely spaced fault-generated mountainous scarps.
And how high up would you be looking?
Well, again, the case of the largest of those scarps, it's over 3 kilometers from the floor of the valley to the top of that scarp.
I was wondering, though, as you were describing it, if you were sitting in the center of the valley, would you actually see the two cliffs?
That's a good question, because you're right. The curvature of the planet, because Mercury is a smaller body.
Yeah.
So if you're sort of standing in the center of that valley, you might not be that impressive looking because the curvature of the planet is going to start having an influence. So those mountains may not look so impressive from right in the middle.
So what are your ideas on how this giant valley on Mercury formed?
Yeah, no, it really, again, we knew that Mercury has been contracting, that cooling of its interior has caused the outer shell, that part of the crust and upper mantle that we call the lithosphere. We knew that was actually contracting, again, in response to cooling of the interior, because as the interior cools, it gets smaller, and then that outer silicate shell has to adjust to that decrease in interior size. So that's going to cause this contraction and compression that will form these fault scarps, where the crust is literally being broken and then thrust up over one side of the crust.
So you're saying that Mercury is shrinking, literally?
Yes. As this outer shell is being contracted, it's actually buckling. So the entire lithosphere of Mercury buckled, and where it bent is where these two great thrust fault scarps developed. And as they were developing and going upward, the valley floor was going downward.
I'm thinking of what happens to fruit when it gets old and starts to dry up and the skin gets all wrinkled.
That's actually an excellent analogy, yes. That's exactly what's happening. You think of the apple skin or an orange peel as being that outer lithospheric shell that covers Mercury, and that it is literally having to shrink and contract and adjust to the interior as it gets smaller because of the cooling.
What went through your mind when you got this stereo view and saw how big this valley on Mercury was?
It was one of those gee whiz moments that I've been very fortunate to have as a planetary scientist. You really can't beat the excitement of viewing something that you've never seen before on a planetary surface. And this really was a surprise, because we thought we understood what was going on in this area from the images, and a whole different picture emerged.
Dr. Waters, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Dr. Tom Waters is a senior scientist at the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. We've got photos and some video of Mercury and its canyon on our website. Have a look at cbc.ca/quarks. That music on HBO on Sunday nights means one thing: Westworld. The action revolves around a futuristic theme park populated by human-like robots. Paying guests visit this world to live out their wildest and most depraved fantasies. Kind of like Grand Theft Auto, but more real, fully immersive, and set in the Old West. When a robot dies or their story plays out, they go back up to the real world for servicing.
Bring her back online. Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm sorry, I'm not feeling quite myself.
You can lose the accent. Do you know where you are?
I'm in a dream.
That's right, Dolores. You're in a dream.
The artificially intelligent robots are programmed not to harm guests, but when new computer code is introduced, they go off script and start to remember things. They even develop a type of consciousness. Now, this is, of course, fiction, but here in the real world, work on artificial intelligence is moving fast. So when it comes to AI systems developing consciousness, how close is Westworld science fiction to science fact? Joining me now to sort fact from fiction is Quarks and Quarks producer Sonia Biting. Hi, Sonia.
Hello, Bob.
Hi. Now, before we get to intelligence, for those who haven't seen the show, just how lifelike are these robotic hosts on Westworld?
Well, to the viewer and the guests in the park, they look totally real. They bleed when they're shot and cry when bad things happen. And the hosts have their own personalities and backstories. And when it comes to their artificial intelligent personalities, what we see in Westworld is actually very similar to what companies are doing today.
Really? How so?
Just look at Apple's virtual assistant, Siri. She's got personality and attitude. And there are companies like Botanic.io that specialize in developing avatars with personalities. Botanic has developed a virtual financial assistant, so if you need financial advice, you connect with the assistant and they want it to seem like a real person. Mark Stephen Meadows is the president of Botanic, and he says he and his colleagues are getting a huge kick out of seeing the similarities between what they do and Westworld.
We really enjoyed watching, in particular, the user interface. While they're down in the labs and they're repairing these characters from Westworld, they have we took a snapshot, and it's held an attributes matrix. And we actually developed at Botanic a personality matrix.
Now, what does he mean by attributes or personality matrix?
It's basically a list of attributes you can assign to a personality. Traits like tenacity, charm, or humility. So Mark's company programs in how much of each trait they want an avatar to have in its personality. I mentioned the virtual financial assistant. They're also working on a health and wellness avatar and programmed it to have empathy.
So if I say, I understand how you feel, that's a lot different than saying, well, I understand how you feel. And the intonation and the way in which words are said are the things that actually include sincerity. So we really look at multimodal interaction, and we try to program in the specific words, and then we try to identify the particular sound of those words, and then what the character should be doing while it's making those particular sounds.
Okay. Well, I mean, sounding like you have empathy is one thing, but that doesn't mean that the machine is sentient or actually has empathy.
No, you're right. It's just code. It doesn't feel anything.
Yeah, well, then how does the avatar know what to say and when?
Well, Mark's company has poets and screenwriters on staff to script prompts and responses. And those responses go into an artificial intelligence system that processes language. And again, the way Mark's company does it is very similar to Westworld. They use something called a unigram sequencing in a Markov chain. And I'm just going to let Mark explain that.
It's basically how we string together words when we combine a sentence. So I could say, hey, it's great to meet you. Or I could say, hi, it's great to meet you. Or I could say, hello, it's great to meet you. And each of those individual words are called unigrams. And a Markov chain is basically just a tree-based logic structure that informs the system when it should be saying which words.
Wow, so it's actually choosing its own words. Can you give me an example of how this all comes together then in an avatar?
Sure. His company helped to develop a virtual wellness companion called I Within. They came up with the personalities, voices, and appearances for the avatars. Here's one of them. Take a listen.
Hello. I'm Lotus, your positivity coach. Are you ready to find greater joy, calm, and clarity in your life?
Yes.
Then Lotus asks, on a scale of 1 to 10, how do you feel? He answers. And then they get to specific issues like work.
The more pleasure you can take in life, the more you can enjoy your work. Is there another thing that is stressing you that would like to tell me about?
My wife.
Ah, relationships. While I can't control the minds of others, I can help you control your own.
Okay.
So the avatar can not only converse with the user, but it can also direct them in ways to make the user feel better. Here's the same virtual wellness companion, I Within, but with a different avatar.
How are you, my friend?
I'm feeling nervous about talking to these people.
Public speaking, my friend, is a common cause of stress, and I am detecting a stress score of 87.
Okay, wait a second here. How does this machine know that this guy was stressed out?
Well, not only is the avatar registering the verbal responses, but it's also looking, and I'm using my finger quotes here, at the user through the smartphone's camera. And that way it analyzes facial expressions and gestures to sense how a person is doing emotionally.
This is getting kind of spooky.
It kind of is.
Okay, so personality-wise, these avatars sound pretty advanced, I guess, but how intelligent are they really?
Well, for Mark's company, Botanic, it all depends on what they're developing and for whom. Some of their avatars just do simple FAQs or frequently asked questions, but others learn from how the users interact with it. That way it can improve, become more human-like, and better serve the user.
Okay, now that is impressive, but it still seems pretty far away from what we see in Westworld.
Yeah, so most of what we just heard was about creating personality and demonstrating and understanding emotions, which is important for making AI convincing, but there's more to it. There's a big area of AI development around deep learning.
And what's that?
Basically, it's when algorithms find patterns in large volumes of data. It's loosely based on how a toddler learns through trial and error. I'll let Dr. Oren Etzioni help us out. He is a professor of computer science at the University of Washington and the CEO of the Allen Institute of Artificial Intelligence.
There's a strong element of, you know, what worked last time, let's do more of that. What didn't work last time, let's do less of that. It's very statistical. And it works by doing, you know, many, many iterations on literally, you know, millions of data points to keep becoming, you know, incrementally better.
Okay, so it's getting smarter, but how does this intelligence compare with how humans reason?
Have you heard about the artificially intelligent system AlphaGo that beat the world champion of the game Go last winter?
I did hear about that win, yes.
So Go is a game that's much more complex than chess. It requires logic and intuition. But when AlphaGo beat the Go world champion, it surprised a lot of people. That said, it still doesn't come near our level of intelligence.
The truth is that none of these systems have even a glimmer of consciousness. For example, AlphaGo doesn't know it won the game. It really has no clue.
So that's his first point. His second point is that human memory is completely different than AI memory.
The notion that they can remember everything, they have an infallible memory is true. On the other hand, human memory is what's called associative. You know, I remember one thing, it reminds me of another, that reminds me of another. You show me something, I have an analogy in mind, right? It's very fluid and really an incredible and distinctively human capability.
Okay, so it doesn't sound like we have to worry yet. What about in the future? Can he foresee any kind of development that could actually lead to artificial intelligence developing consciousness like Data on Star Trek?
That is pure speculation at this point. But yes, some think with all of these advances we're making and continue to make, it could lead to some kind of super intelligence. But Dr. Etzioni says most top AI researchers don't think that's the case.
Most of us, you know, 92.5% in my survey of leading AI researchers, believe that in the next 25 years, we won't see these kinds of science fiction type of things. And the truth is that projecting beyond 25 years is really puts you in the realm of science fiction.
Which brings us back to Westworld. That was a great discussion, Sonia.
Thank you, Bob.
That's Quirks and Quarks producer, Sonia Biting. Coming up next, Fear on the Brain. As we just heard, the TV show Westworld imagines a place where robots gain memories that have been denied to them in the past. The traumas they experienced are now accessible, and it changes them from wandering along in happy robotic ignorance to wanting to act on those bad memories. Well, just like the real doctors who are charging forward into the brave new world of AI, others are working to manipulate bad memories in human brains. Just about everyone is afraid of something, from spiders and snakes to dark places or deep water. And these phobias create a fear memory in our brain that can be recalled every time we see that scary thing with eight legs, for example. A new study by Dr. Ben Seymour, a clinical neuroscientist from the Department of Engineering at Cambridge University in England, has found a way that those fearful memories can be overridden with positive ones. New technology can turn our fear in the brain into a distant memory. Dr. Seymour, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Hello.
What are these fear memories that are in the brain?
Fear memories are usually relate to something that we either innately or some past experience which has essentially deeply affected us and our ability to get on with our life.
So it's a trigger that happens in the brain when we rethink something that's happened in the past?
There is a range of different ways in which fear can cause disorders. There are things like phobias, which is where we have a specific fear of some specific thing, like a spider or flying. And then there are kind of fear memories of traumatic events which have happened in the past. So this usually relates to things like post-traumatic stress disorder. And these, you know, these disorders, these phobias and PTSD, can be debilitating. So there's a great need for some sort of new treatment.
Well, what has been the traditional approach to treating phobias and overcoming these fears?
So the conventional way is usually some sort of exposure therapy or behavioral therapy, which involves reliving the experience. And these are designed to try to get you to appreciate and understand that, you know, the object of your fear is not actually harmful. The problem with these, though, is that, of course, they involve continually re-exposing yourself to the thing you're afraid of during a process by which your fear hopefully is gradually reduced. So the process itself is inherently, you know, unpleasant, aversive, and indeed that stops many people going for these sorts of therapies.
What's your new approach?
So we're thinking, you know, is there some way we can access or override or reduce these fear memories in an unconscious manner? And that led us, and with our colleagues in Japan, in Kyoto, to try to come up with some sort of new, conceptually new approach using, you know, advances in brain imaging technology and artificial intelligence. So effectively what we've done is we've developed a method to kind of listen in on the information in the brain. So for things like spiders, or, you know, where it is the image, the visual image of a spider which triggers a memory, we can listen in on the visual cortex at the back of the brain. And what our method does is try to listen in for fragments of that of the information which relates to some fearful trigger and try to override it. The core idea here is that we can kind of decode information in the brain which relates to different things.
Well, take me through your experiment. How did you find all of this?
The experiment proceeds in several steps, and the first step we do is look at our ability to decode, that is, read information in the brain. We get people to look at a number of pictures on the computer screen. These pictures are kind of round circles with a different colours. And we build our sort of artificial intelligence decoder to distinguish those. So we can tell, for instance, if you're looking at a red circle or a blue circle or a green circle or whatever. The next step is that we then create a mild fear memory for one of those circles. And we do that using what we call Pavlovian conditioning. So this is simply pairing one of those pictures with a small electric shock. So what that does is when you see that picture in the future, you know that this is associated with electric shock. And you'll get a mild fear response. You'll get a bit of skin sweating, slight increase in your heart rate, and you'll get activity in the fear centers of the brain. So once we've created that mild fear memory, the goal is to try to reduce it.
Okay. And you mentioned artificial intelligence there. What's that role?
The key innovation which has come around in the last few years is that you can get access to the actual information content in the brain by picking apart the complex patterns of activity across the broad brain area, across the whole of the brain. So this is what we call decoding, and it's kind of like brain reading or mind reading, if you like.
So the artificial intelligence is looking for a pattern that's fear.
It's looking for a pattern that represents a thing which triggers the fear.
All right, so once you've got your artificial intelligence recognizing the fear trigger in the brain, you've stimulated this mild fear with the person. When they look at this blue dot, they get the shock. What's your next step?
So then what we do is we get subjects to lie down and we don't show them any of the original triggering stimuli. So in effect, they're almost lying down at rest. But we're constantly listening on their visual cortex, on their brain, to look to see whether we get any patterns of activity which bear some sort of similarity to the fear triggering stimulus. So even when the person is lying there doing nothing and is not thinking about the thing which is fearful, you will, from time to time, get a pattern of activity across the brain which has some resemblance, maybe it has some features, some similarity to the fear-triggering stimulus, even though fear never enters their actual consciousness. When we see that, when we pick that up, what we do is, as quickly as possible, we give them a reward, so something pleasant. And the idea is that positive value is then associated or attached to that fear-trigger related pattern to try to, you know, attach some sort of positive value to it.
What was the reward you gave them?
Just a small amount of money.
You paid them to get over their fear.
I think the principle more is that you set a goal. So in fact, you could do anything nice to someone. It just has to be something that is not aversive.
Okay. So when that fear pattern appears in their brain, even though they're not being shown the fearful object, you reward them. So
yeah.
What effect did that have?
We do this over several days. So you know, the idea is that if you continually apply these very small rewards, you gradually chip away at the fear memory. So when we test this at the end of the study, we show the original patterns again, and we see that the fear response to the fear triggering pattern is significantly reduced. So in effect, we've overwritten or we've inhibited or reduced the size of that fear memory.
What impact could this have on treating people with serious conditions like PTSD?
I think the procedure itself, this idea of kind of applying technology and artificial intelligence and trying to modulate brain activity, could have applicability in a number of areas. So this is a field which is a sort of new field which is called clinical neuroengineering. The idea that you can apply technology-based solutions to problems in psychiatry and neurology, I think has some value, and indeed probably a welcome value in the context of alternative treatments such as drugs. So patients are surprisingly receptive to the idea that technology might be an alternative to drug-related treatments. So conditions such as PTSD and other disorders are open. There's a range of different candidates which you could think of applying this sort of general approach to. But it is, it remains an ambitious challenge to develop this into something which is clinically useful. Mm-hmm. But it is a challenge worth taking.
Dr. Seymour, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Ben Seymour is from the Department of Engineering at Cambridge University in England and the National Institute for Information and Communication Technology in Osaka, Japan. We know that about 71% of the Earth is covered in water. The exact amount is staggering, measured in hundreds of thousands of cubic kilometers. But it's not known exactly how much water is in the Earth. It's important to try to understand this because water plays an important role in the geological activity below the Earth's surface. Without water, that geology would change. But that's not going to happen anytime soon, according to Dr. Mainak Mukherjee, a professor in the Department of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at Florida State University in Tallahassee. A new study has found that water exists much deeper in the Earth than previously thought. Dr. Mukherjee, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Now, I think most of us think of water in the earth as what you find when you dig a well. So how far down does water actually go?
Well, water, not as a liquid water, but it can get incorporated in minerals. We typically call them hydrous minerals, and almost all the way till the core mantle boundary. But they occur in very trace quantities, but they are replenished by these hydrogen-bearing hydrous phases, which can actually bring down water along subduction zones. But the question is, who brings it and how far can they go? Because if they decompose, they will release the water back, and less amount of water will be available for these dry minerals.
So when you're saying that the water is stored down in the earth, it's not actually in the liquid form that bubbles up in our wells?
Yes, they are not as a liquid form. They are stored within these solid phases, so it's a condensed matter, solid matter.
Okay, so they're part of the mineral structures. How far can these sort of water-bearing minerals go down into the earth?
Well, what was known previously is minerals such as brucite, which is a hydrous mineral, will probably decompose in at very shallow conditions. Our new study indicates that that's not the case. There are newer, much denser phases of brucite which can actually take the water way below 400 kilometer depth or so.
400 kilometers down, that's a long way.
Yeah, indeed, and it can still survive beyond 600 kilometers or so, and after which they will probably start decomposing and releasing the water back. Part of it will be then absorbed by these dry minerals.
Ah, so the brucite can hold water deeper into the earth than you previously thought. So how much more water do you think is down there if the brucite is stable?
Yeah, that is a really good question. So the current estimate varies from anywhere between one mass worth of ocean to somewhat higher.
Boy.
That, of course, depends on where you're looking at.
Boy, so you're saying mm-hmm. that the earth has another ocean inside itself.
Indeed, yes.
Now, what's the role of that water in the earth?
that is the key question. Without the water, let's say, if we imagine a planet without water, imagining Earth without the water, it will eventually die off, because water helps somewhat like lubricating the geodynamic activity. That means all the solid matter that what is there in the Earth's interior, they're under constant motion. They're slowly moving, and that from the hotter regions to the cooler regions, and the process is called mantle convection. This is the effective mechanism through which Earth releases its heat. Now, if there was no water, this convection part, where the rock is in constant motion from the hotter to cooler region, will eventually cease to exist. That means the heat that is there, the primordial heat, will not be able to escape. The planet will heat up, and eventually it will probably end up somewhat like Venus or so, which is essentially a dead planet. So that is an extreme scenario. That may occur if there is no water.
Boy. So are you saying that the water that's within the Earth is actually helping the activity? We hear about things like plate tectonics and volcanoes and earthquakes. Are you saying that the water deep in the Earth is responsible for that, or it has a critical role to play?
It certainly has a critical role to play. Without water, all these activities will change. They will not be as we see today in the Earth.
Well, take me through the process then. You say that the water is incorporated into this brucite, this mineral that's down below. So what happens when the mineral releases that water? What's the chain of events?
Mostly, if brucite were to release the water in the shallower part of the Earth, then most of the water will be recycled back to volcanism. However, this present study shows that the brucite will be able to release the water at much greater depth. And at these depths, the dry minerals will be efficiently taking up this water. And the dry mineral will then be able to sustain this geodynamic activity in a smoother way. So they will be able to convect over geological timescales, because there are trace quantities of water within the mineral that will help the lubrication process of the geodynamics. And that way they will be able to release the heat, and the planet will continue to live and continue to operate as it is doing now.
Boy. So are you saying then that the water that comes out of volcanoes that we see today, is that what has been released from deep within the Earth?
Absolutely, yeah. All these Mount Sentinels and other volcanoes where you have copious amount of gases coming out, those are essentially dissolved water when they come out to the surface. It's almost like releasing a bottle of Coke. You have dissolved carbon dioxide, and as you open the bottle, the carbon dioxide bubbles out. The gas separates from the liquid. What you see in these volcanoes is that you have molten matter in which all these volatiles, such as water and carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide, are dissolved. And as you release the lid, it just vents up, and all the smoke that you see is essentially the gas phase exhausting out of the molten matter.
Mm. You mentioned Venus being a dead planet, and I think we're seeing from Mars there's no water, or at least on the surface around there.
Mm-hmm.
How does this compare the Earth to some of the other planets that we know about?
We are very fortunate that all these planetary activities on the planet are existing, and that actually helps mankind. The other planets may have had water in the past, and that's the key thing that astronomers or planetary geologists often look for, surface evidences of the water. But at this moment in the Earth, we have this conveyor belt in which we are replenishing the water in the Earth's interior through these hydrostases, and it is going to continue.
So the Earth is truly a water planet inside and out.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes.
Dr. Mukherjee, thank you very much for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Mynak Mukherjee is a professor in the Department of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at Florida State University in Tallahassee. And that's it for this week's edition of Quartz and Quarks. If you'd like to get in touch with us, go to the contact link on our webpage. And to get to our webpage, go to cbc.ca/quirks, where you can subscribe to our podcast, listen to our audio archives, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at CBC Quirks, and read our latest blog. You can also listen on the free CBC Radio app. It lets you browse through past episodes of our show and start listening in just a few seconds. Or you can listen live to your local CBC station right from your smartphone or tablet. It's free from the App Store or Google Play. Quirks and Quarks is produced by Sonia Biting, Mark Crawley, and Tina Verma, with technical assistance from Steve Sweeney. Our executive producer is Nick McCabe-Locos. I'm Bob McDonald.
Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.